Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Immigration Status and Travel Abroad Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On May 21, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Holder v. Gutierrez and Holder v. Sawyers. The decision in Vartelos v. Holder, a related case, was issued on March 28. The central issue in Holder v. Gutierrez and Holder v. Sawyers was whether a non-citizen who cannot himself meet the requirements to avoid deportation, to have lived in the United States for at least 7 years and have been a lawful permanent resident for at least 5 years, can nevertheless avoid deportation if, while still a minor, he lived with a parent who could meet these requirements. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kagan, the court held unanimously in Holder v. Gutierrez and Holder v. Sawyers that the Board of Immigration Appeals' interpretation of the relevant statute, that an alien must personally meet the status residency requirements to avoid deportation, and that parental status residency cannot be imputed, was a permissible interpretation and entitled to judicial deference. The issue in Vartelos v. Holder was whether a statute providing for the denial of reentry to a lawful permanent resident who travels abroad after having been convicted of certain offenses can be applied retroactively to a legal permanent resident who was convicted prior to the passage of the statute. In an opinion delivered by Justice Ginsburg, the court held by a vote of 6-3 that the legal regime in force at the time of Vartelos' conviction governs whether he may re-enter the United States after traveling abroad, not the retroactive application of a statute passed after the date of his conviction. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kennedy, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined Justice Ginsburg's opinion. Justice Scalia filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Thomas and Alito. To discuss these cases, we have Amy Moore, who is an associate professor at Belmont University College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Moore.
The first two cases, Holder v. Gutierrez and Holder v. Sawyers, were consolidated together by the Supreme Court, and they're more about administrative law and statutory interpretation than they are immigration law. For the court, the answer to the problem turned fundamentally on deference to the Board of Immigration Appeals via Chevron. To back up for a minute, the problem presented in Gutierrez and Sawyers stems from Section 1229BA of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which reads, quote, "The Attorney General may cancel removal in the case of an alien who is inadmissible or deportable from the United States if the alien, one, has been an alien lawfully admitted for permanent residence for not less than 5 years, two, has resided in the United States continuously for 7 years after having been admitted in any status, and three, has not been convicted of an aggravated felony." The statute merely sets up the criteria by which the Attorney General may cancel removal. If an alien satisfies the statutory requirements, the Attorney General must still exercise his or her discretion in making the final decision. The question for the court centered on the statutory requirements themselves, in particular the time requirements of 5 years and 7 years. The question occurs when a parent meets the time requirements, but his or her child does not, because the child enters the country or gains lawful permanent resident status after one of his or her parents. Must the child be considered independently for calculation of time under the statute, or may the parent's time be imputed to the child? Will the parent's residence time count towards the child's residence time? This is a clear issue of statutory interpretation. But in order to get the full picture, we need to back up a little further. In 1996, Congress repealed Section 212C of the Immigration and Nationality Act and got rid of the discretionary waiver in favor of cancellation of removal in Section 1229BA, a more narrow tool for relief. Most notably, this change got rid of the word domicile in exchange for the word residence, which, as interpreted by the board, permitted a change from allowing imputation of time to disallowing imputation of time. Up until this point, on the basis of 212C's use of the word domicile, every court of appeals that had considered the issue had held imputation of time was allowed from parent to child. This was found in the Second, Third, and Ninth Circuits. When the wording changed from domicile to residence, the Board of Immigration Appeals changed its stance. In 2005, the Ninth Circuit was the first court of appeals to confront the issue of imputation in a Section 1229BA context in Cuevas-Gaspar v. Gonzalez. The court held that imputation of time was still allowed from parent to child in spite of the fact that the board had held in that case imputation was not allowed. The board reiterated its decision in the case of N. Ray Escobar in 2007, where it clearly determined that imputation was not available under the statute. The board held that residence was classified as a status under the statute that did not require the formation of any intent, unlike domicile, which does require the formation of intent. So while intent could be imputed from parent to child, physical location alone or residence as a status could not. Thus, the change in statutory wording allowed for the board to alter its interpretation without being inconsistent. Eventually, the board held in matter of Ramirez-Vargas that the Ninth Circuit should defer to the board's reasoning in Escobar. A circuit split developed over the reasonableness of the board's decision about imputation. The Third and Fifth Circuits held the decision as reasonable, and the Ninth Circuit, in the words of the court, doubled down on its contrary view that the board's decision was unreasonable. At this point, the Supreme Court had to deal with the reasonableness of the board's statutory interpretation and not just interpret the statute itself. This immediately implies Chevron deference, probably one of the only things people remember from taking administrative law in school. The court applied Chevron to give deference with a unanimous voice. As to Chevron Step 0, or whether or not this particular agency action requires Chevron deference, the court answered this in INS versus Aguirre-Aguirre, where it held that Chevron deference is accorded to the board's interpretation of the INA. For Gutierrez and Sawyer's cases, the court explicitly said the board's view on imputation met that standard. Chevron Step 1 then asks whether this is an issue of ambiguity or has Congress already spoken to this issue. The text of the statute does not speak directly to the issue of imputation and refers to no third party other than the alien. No other evidence was given that Congress had spoken to this issue on its own. That moves us briskly onto Chevron Step 2, which asks whether the agency interpretation is reasonable, the very issue that caused the circuit split. The court determined the interpretation was reasonable on several grounds. First, the board's approach is consistent with the statute's text, as no third parties are mentioned. Second, although we assume Congress was familiar with imputation taking place under old Section 212C, Congress edited the statute and removed domicile and replaced it with residence, so it did not ratify an imputation requirement into the statute. The court says that the doctrine of congressional ratification can only apply when Congress reenacts a statute without relevant change. Third, the purposes of the Act do not require imputation. The court recognized that the Act does have the objective of promoting family unity and providing relief to those with strong ties to the United States, but this doesn't overcome a statute that is silent on the issue of imputation. In order for the court to side with the Ninth Circuit, the statute would have to require imputation as the only reasonable statutory construction. Fourth, the board's decision is not inconsistent. The Ninth Circuit pointed to the sea change between the interpretation of domicile and residence, but the board explained in Escobar the reason for this change was that imputation was allowed for mental states, but not for statuses, and the court was persuaded that this was reasonable. And finally, fifth, there were no anomalies in the board's decision. Respondents had argued that the board adopted a no imputation rule only because it thought it had no other choice. The court said, quote, the decision expressed the board's view based on its experience implementing the INA, the statutory text, administrative practice, and regulatory policy all pointed in one direction, toward disallowing imputation. Therefore, there were no red flags that would deter Chevron deference. The third case, Bartalis versus Holder, also involves a 1996 change to immigration law with the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, and whether its application in some cases constitutes a retroactive effect. Before 1996, there were two types of hearings to expel foreign nationals, deportation hearings and exclusion hearings. Deportation was the removal of a non-citizen who had entered the United States, whether he or she had done so legally or illegally. Exclusion hearings were for those who have not yet accomplished an entry, but rather were being turned away before any admission to the United States. So even if an immigrant had entered the country illegally but stood on United States soil, he or she got the slightly greater process of one who is being deported rather than excluded. In 1996, the Immigration and Nationality Act shifted from geographical exclusion to the administrative concept of admission. The Act renamed the exclusion grounds as inadmissibility grounds. It also deleted the definition of entry and substituted a definition of admission. The question thus shifted from whether a non-citizen had entered the country or not to whether a non-citizen had been admitted or was seeking admission. There are grounds under which the government can deport someone, and there are grounds under which the government can refuse entry to someone. These grounds are mostly similar, but sometimes divergent. So there are some instances in which someone could be refused entry for something, but not deported for the same offense or act. For example, a single crime of moral turpitude can render an alien inadmissible, but not deportable. This makes the determination of whether the alien is being deported or not admitted very important. IRIRA further added that some lawful permanent residents who leave the country and attempt to return could be rendered inadmissible when they try to come back and turned away rather than being deportable. Under the old regime, LPRs who were not deportable but would be inadmissible could come and go as they pleased to an extent. Under the new regime, LPRs who were not deportable but could be considered inadmissible if they tried to enter the country after a visit abroad could be removed as such. That's the situation that arose in this case. Vartelis, an LPR from Greece, pled guilty to conspiracy to make or possess counterfeit securities in 1994. He made many trips to and from Greece after that time, even after the passage of IRIRA. In 2003, during a return from one of these visits, an official claimed he was seeking admission and was removable as being inadmissible. When the Second Circuit ruled that Vartelis was indeed inadmissible, it created a circuit split. The Second Circuit held that because the law applies to travel taken post-IRIRA, there is no impermissible retroactive application of the law. The Fourth and Ninth Circuits have held that because the law applies to crimes committed prior to the enactment of IRIRA, there is an impermissible retroactive application of the law. The question is not whether the law can be applied retroactively, but to what event is the law being applied, the pre-IRIRA crime that renders the alien inadmissible, or the post-IRIRA travel when admissibility is reconsidered. One makes the act retroactive and impermissible. One makes it prospective and permissible. In the case, Vartelis conceded that Congress may restrict reentry into the country in this way, and that it may make this kind of restriction apply retroactively. The only issue is that such retroactivity must be explicit. Courts presume that laws are only prospective in application unless Congress has unambiguously instructed retroactivity. In other words, because his conviction was before the law change, he argues it should not have new travel restrictions as consequences attached to it because of the act. This decision really affects a small group of people, those with convictions pre-IRIRA that desire to travel in and out of the country post-IRIRA. The majority opinion written by Justice Ginsburg first recognized the background principle that laws are presumed to be prospective. The sticking point for the majority was when the criminal activity occurred. Because no criminal activity occurs after the passage of IRIRA for aliens like Vartelis, the law should not add another penalty, like the inability to travel overseas, for conduct that occurred in the past. Thus, the majority distinguished this from other situations, like RICO and even aliens who re-enter illegally under IRIRA, where the criminal activity is ongoing or occurs after the passage of the relevant act. Travel, for aliens like Vartelis, is an entirely innocent act. The court was not concerned with reliance or whether Vartelis had relied on the state of immigration law either when he committed his offense or when he pled guilty to that offense. Rather, the court was concerned with unfairness inherent wherever the law imposes additional burdens based on conduct that occurred in the past. Even if Vartelis did rely on the state of immigration law at the time, and he probably did, it's the background assumption that laws are prospective only that really matters. Any reliance just strengthens the argument in the court's view. Justice Scalia dissented, joined by Justice Thomas and Justice Alito. For Scalia, the case turned on statutory interpretation and not fairness. To determine retroactivity, Scalia says we have to think about how the statute operates towards regulated parties and not about retroactivity as an abstract concept or as a substitute for fairness concerns. We have to determine a, quote, reference point, the moment at which the party does what the statute forbids or fails to do what it requires. Scalia argues that because IRIRA intends to regulate admission at the border, there is no retroactive effect here. In other words, because Vartelis tried to re-enter the country after the passage of the act, there is no impermissible retroactive effect. In contrast, the majority's reference point is the commission of the offense itself that renders the alien inadmissible, which occurred before the passage of the act, creating an impermissible retroactive effect. Scalia looks to the text of the statute to confirm his argument. The terms of the statute are all about controlling admission at the border, and even the titles of the sections focus on admission as opposed to crime. Vartelis cannot change his past conviction, but he can control leaving and reentering the United States, and could have avoided the entire scenario by staying in the United States. Scalia argues that because the statute had no effect on Vertalis until after he performed a post-enactment activity, this proves that IRIRA's application is only prospective. The majority, in the view of the dissent, does not base its argument in the statute's text or structure, and Scalia says the court does not pretend otherwise. Even if the reason for prohibition on travel is past conduct, Scalia reasons, reasoning for prohibitions have nothing to do with whether the prohibition itself is being applied to a past act or a future act. Reasons for prohibitions may be important for other legal inquiries, but this is not one of them. Scalia scolds the majority for reasoning that because banning overseas travel is unfair, it will not apply the statute properly for that purpose. He points to laws prohibiting persons convicted of drug crimes from getting student loans and laws prohibiting persons convicted of sex crimes from working with minors. Each example puts a new disability on someone that relates to past events, but none of the examples listed were deemed to apply retroactively. The majority tries to distinguish these examples by attaching a dangerousness component. In other words, in order to prevent dangers that might arise post-enactment, we regulate behavior retroactively. Overseas travel isn't dangerous in and of itself, so why apply a ban on it retroactively? However, Scalia points out that guarding against future danger isn't the only reason Congress might wish to regulate post-enactment conduct. This new test, as he calls it, has nothing to do with retroactivity and is confusing at best. Here, the case is clear-cut. Convicted criminal Vertalis, in violation of the statute, traveled to and from Greece and should be removed as inadmissible.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.